Good evening. This is Naftali Off speaking. I believe that everybody is muted, and so unless there is some type of introduction to be made, I guess I will get started. So thank you to Mr. Israel for inviting me to tonight's call. And I thought I would begin the discussion of the Parsha by just pointing out how unusual the Parsha is in so many ways. You know, we typically think of Kisis as the Parsha of the Egel, and rightfully so. There's so much to unpack in terms of that story, that incident, and its impact on our history. But the lead up to it is curious, at the least, in the sense that the beginning of the Parsha, the first number of Psukim through the balance of Perek Lamed, and all of Perek with Kapitel Lamed Aleph, talk about other elements relating to the Mishkan that were not discussed in the previous Parshios. Before we go into those, it's just noteworthy to talk about the sequence of the Torah. Typically speaking, we think of the Torah as chronologically presented, certainly at least until this point in our history, the sequence of Sefer Bereishis and then Sefer Shemos leading up to this point. And perhaps with the exception of Parshas Yisro, where the beginning of the Parsha presents an incident, a story involving Moshe and Yisro that, according to many Mefarshim, took place later on, this is the first, what we might call macro-level event, where it is presented out of order. So the Mishkan, which, you know, it's always hard to know what exactly the plan would have been had not certain things occurred. I'll digress for a moment to sort of pick up on that point. Ramban talks about the idea, you're probably familiar with Ma'asa Avosim Labanim, that the incidents, the events of the forefathers influence the deeds and the activities, the experiences of their children. And so Ramban says, in a fascinating pirush in Perek Yud Beis, I'd like to say, in Parshas Lech Lecha, he says that if not for the fact that Avraham had chosen, and he uses some very interesting language. I know Rav Schwab talks about Chet Chata, Avraham Avinu v'Shkaga, Chata Gedol, I believe it was, that he sinned a tremendous sin, but he did it b'shogeg, not getting to what all of that means. But he says that if not for the fact that Avraham had come down to Mitzrayim earlier on and had that entire incident in which Sarah was troubled or harassed, and it came because of famine, and he went out through Chush Gadol, that actually became the mirror, if you will, of what happened much later on, or actually not that much later on, but hundreds of years later, with Klal Yisrael at large, where they also came down to Mitzrayim because of famine. They also were bothered and oppressed. They also eventually left through Chush Gadol, and he says that that is the idea of Ma'asa Avosim Labanim, which implies, of course, that in some way, shape, or form, had Avram not done that, maybe the story of Mitzrayim could have potentially looked different. And so in our parsha, we talk about the Egel, which we'll get to, and the Egel, ultimately, the kapara for the Egel was manifested through the allowance to build the Mishkan. And yet the Mishkan is presented in previous parshios already as if it's unrelated completely to what's going on in our parsha. The only part of the Mishkan that seems to connect is at the very beginning, because we talk about things like the chatzi shekel, and then we talk about the kiyar, which was a component of the Mishkan, of course, and the Shemen HaMishcha, and the role of Betzalel and Aliyav in terms of developing the Mishkan, though we had been introduced to them earlier. And then after a brief reference to Shabbos, we then move into the story of the Egel. So it's almost as if the Parsha starts by finishing up, tying up the loose ends relating to the Mishkan, and when that is done, then it goes into this seminal event in Jewish history. It is worth noting, without getting to each of these separately and what their respective value is and significance, because I don't know that we have the time necessarily to unpack them individually, it is interesting that all of them are presented as a way by which to avert calamity and catastrophe, because each of them talked about that if you do it and do it correctly, it will prevent some form of death. So we know, for example, that we are not supposed to count us, Klal Yisrael should not be counted individually. We're only supposed to be counted through some other form, in this case, of course, referring to the chatzi shekel. And the pasuk says that, let's see over here, that it's a matter by which to avoid any form of negev. Lo yeh behem negev bifkodos. There shouldn't be any type of magefa in the counting. Of course, we see that with David HaMelech. And then as it relates to the kiyar, so it's described, of course, as the kli by which Aaron and his sons will enter into the mikdash b'tahara. And it says, b'vor malo amod yuchatsumayim v'lo yamusu, that they should wash with water and they shall not die. And then as you continue along and talk about the Shemen HaMishcha, which is created in the Besamim, and then eventually the Shemen HaMishcha, also uses language to avoid, it says over here, that if a person doesn't do it correctly, v'nichras me'amav, he will be cut off from his nation. So I know that there's got to be some kind of connection with all of these, and you see it again actually two times in this parsha, in the middle of, actually towards the end of Perek Lamed, and then the end of Perek Lamed, both of them, in describing whether it's the Besamim themselves or the Shemen HaMishcha, which was necessary, of course, to anoint the different components of the Mishkan, doing it correctly, following exactly as the Kadosh Baruch Hu lays out, and one who doesn't do so, v'nichras me'amav, would be cut off. So there's this balance here, if you will, between doing things the right way, bringing Kedusha into the world, and the counter to that, of course, is Nisa. The counter to that is disconnection, disassociation, being removed from the source, which I think in many ways really is the underlying issue, if you will, of this week's Parsha. Because we have here this event, which if you can talk about swinging a pendulum from one end to another, I don't know if there's ever a situation which could be more extreme. I mean, maybe you could argue the Meraglim as well because of the fact that Klal Yisrael is about to go into Eretz Yisrael, so the opportunity is great, and then they have this massive setback. But I think even more so, as you think about the Egel, first of all, it was the earlier of the two, and it kind of set the tone for what would follow. But the fact that Klal Yisrael had literally experienced Ma'amid Har Sinai and had that tremendous revelation, and now, just a short period afterwards, when Moshe Rabbeinu had gone up to Har Sinai in order to bring the Torah down, the Luchos specifically, to Klal Yisrael, all of a sudden we have this major drop-off. So I think we do have to talk about this relationship between good and bad, between Torah and the opposite, and all of that. And I think we'll be able to unpack that as we continue. I do want to point out, from a Jewish history standpoint, there are a number of dates here that are significant. Right? We wouldn't have Tisha B'Av as the day of that it became, presumably, if not for the fact that that was the day that Moshe Rabbeinu came down, witnessed what was going on with the Egel, and broke the Luchos. We also know that Aleph Elul is the first day of the the second 40-day period, which ultimately results in Moshe returning with the second set of Luchos, and that of course is on the day of Yom Kippur. So a number of days in Jewish history that we all know and we've come to know in a very specific kind of way take their initial form in this week's parsha. And Jewish history is very different. You know, it's interesting when you think about, you know, I guess you'd say holidays, general holidays, legal holidays. So if you think about American holidays, for example, so July 4th represents a certain historical event, the Declaration of Independence, at which point America became, at least officially, its own nation. And certain other dates that are commemorated as well, for the most part, commemorate a historical event. But the event itself came and went. And then, of course, you have, you have the celebration, you have the symbolism, you have all of those things, and of course that makes them noteworthy and worthy of celebration. Jewish history and Jewish holidays are different because we're not just commemorating an event. What we are commemorating, in effect, is the unleashing, if you will. Right. That's what talks about this in length. The unleashing of a spiritual force, unleashing of a spiritual, let's call it potential, at a particular time, and that potential is restored to us on an annual basis. So, for example, when we say on Pesach that it's Zman Cheruseinu, What we're saying is that at the time of freedom, not only once upon a time in the year 2448 when the Jewish people were living in Mitzrayim, but that every year we come back to it and we have that opportunity to tap into it again. It's almost like, you know, if you're familiar with a slinky toy or any kind of spring. So if you extend it from a higher point to a lower point and you keep it exactly straight so that the one coil is rotating directly underneath the coil above it. So, and then you could take a very precise drill type tool and you kind of drill a hole in that one spot and then it makes a hole in the spot directly beneath it, et cetera, continuing to drill in that same point. That's, in a sense, what Jewish history is like. It's like this massive coil that continues to rotate downward, you could say upward, whatever the direction is, it doesn't really matter, year over year, and every year is another rotation through that. And we reconnect with certain points on the calendar and with the potential that those dates are infused with. And that infusion took place based off of an initial moment in history. So again, Pesach represents our Cheirus. Tisha B'Av, unfortunately, has become a day of Avelos, and we continue to experience that and continue to experience it many, many times over the course of Jewish history. And then you have the month of Elul, the Bimei Ratzon, the 40 days from the first day of Elul through Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur itself, of course, has become a day of Mechila and Kapara for us for all of history. All that has been framed from this week's Parsha. So there's a lot just thinking about it in those terms. But I do want to come back to that question that we talked about briefly before, the idea of this massive, let's call it spiritual drop-off. And it's not, of course, the only time that we have it in these Parshios. And I think most of us are startled a little bit, even though we know the story. How is it possible that Klal Yisrael, who had just experienced so much, could drop so quickly? Because, you know, if you or I would be witnessing the open revelations of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's hard for us to imagine such a drop-off. In fact, the Maharal says, with regards to, you're probably familiar with the Gemara, the Gemara says that Hashem took the mountain, he took Har Sinai, and he elevated it over the Jewish people. Kafa Alein Har Kigigas. He took the mountain and he put it over them like a roof or like a barrel, and he threatened them. And he said, if you're going to keep my Torah mutav, then everything is good. And if not, sham tiek forachem, this will be the place of your burial. And, you know, the question is asked, well, why was that necessary? They said, na'aseh v'nishma. Let's leave that out for the moment. The Maharal says that it wasn't that, the Gemara is not being literal here. He understands it as being allegorical in the following sense, that the clarity, the absolute truth that was manifest at Har Sinai was such that there was no recourse. There was no alternative. There was no other way of thinking about things. And so it was, you were forced, not in the sense of physical compulsion, but you were forced intellectually. There was no alternative. And that's what Kofen Alein Har Kigigas is. So if we have a situation where it's absolutely clear to us, and we read about Naz Yashir, Chilach Az Yoshef, Lashas Az Nifalu Alufei Adam, all of the nations were trembling, everybody was afraid, they all saw the hand of Hashem, and of course what the Jewish people themselves saw in the time and their experience there before leaving. How is it possible that we can come to a parsha like Kisisa in a moment like the Ego, where Moshe Rabbeinu, they already had experienced Maimon Har Sinai, their leader is up on the top of the mountain, he's receiving the Torah, he's going to be bringing it down imminently. How is it possible that the Ego could take place? And of course, it's a difficult parsha, even with what we know, there's so much that we don't know. But I think it's important, first of all, we know that the people who were involved in the incident of the Ego, for the most part, were the Erev Rav. They weren't necessarily what we'd call the core members of Klal Yisrael. In fact, Rav Dessler points out that it was a relatively small percentage. Not quite what we see in Sefer Yehoshua. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the fact that the Jewish people, they lost the battle after Yericho, they lost the battle of Ai. And the Torah tells us, or the Navi tells us, that kishisha v'shloshim ish, like 36 men died, and there's a whole discussion in Chazal whether it was one person who was the equivalent of more than half the Sanhedrin, which is where the number 36 comes from, which is slightly more than half of the 71 members of the Sanhedrin, or if it was actually 36 people, a relatively small number of people died, but they lost the battle, and they weren't supposed to lose any battle. And when Yehoshua davens to Hashem, similar to what happens in this week's parsha, he's told Chatei Yisrael, that the Jewish people have sinned. And who was it that sinned? We know there was only one person, and his name was Achan. And Achan had taken spoils when Yehoshua had forbidden spoils to be taken during the Battle of Jericho. Achan had taken spoils anyway, and as a result, they lost the next battle. And all of Klal Yisrael was considered to be at fault because of the fact that this had occurred. And Rav Dessler, so that really speaks to the same point as what we're describing over here, the idea that a relatively small percentage of Klal Yisrael participated in the Egel, and yet all of Klal Yisrael is viewed as guilty. Everybody lost the Luchos. Moshe Rabbeinu was not selective in terms of who he gave Tochacha to, even though not necessarily did everybody die, but the fact is it was viewed as a communal sin. And so on that point, before we come back to what I was saying earlier, Rav Dessler points out that we have an obligation as a nation, but it's a collective responsibility to maintain a certain standard. It's our responsibility to make sure that everybody recognizes and that everybody feels the importance of our mission as Jews and what it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. And so therefore, when there is, it's not simply a matter of Kol Yisrael or Revim Zebezeh that, you know, I'm responsible for your behavior. That responsibility emerges from a sense of I need to create conditions in which it would be, for all intents and purposes, an impossibility for somebody to sin, certainly to sin on this level. And so for Klal Yisrael to for Achan to have been able to take the spoils must have been that the level of Klal Yisrael was in some way lacking. It didn't have that same degree of commitment, that same degree of connection to what it is that the leader had demanded of them. And as a result, somebody felt that he had the ability to get away with it, and it wasn't such, let's call it, a violation of societal communal norms. And the same thing is true ultimately with the ego, that there was a pagam, there was some type of deficit, there was some type of lack of connection, despite the open miracles and everything that Klal Yisrael had experienced, that allowed some people to take matters into their own hands, however they understood it, whatever their ultimate intentions were. It was wrong, and it should not have occurred. And it was something that could happen because of the fact that Klal Yisrael at large weren't holding at a level that would have prevented that minority from doing what they did. And as a result, everybody is blamed. But again, that begs the question that we asked before: how is it that a nation that had experienced so much, that had seen so much, would be able to fall so precipitously and so rapidly as Klal Yisrael? And there's a lot of discussion. I believe the Rambam talks about this, and Rambam says that, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the ideas of our faith are not rooted in miracle, right? And there's actually an interesting story that I heard about Rav Yisrael Salanter, that he was at an inn, and maybe the innkeeper was no longer Shomer Shabbos. And the innkeeper had a daughter who was very talented, and she was a musician. And so somebody went to Rabbi Yisrael and said to him, maybe you could talk to the innkeeper. Maybe you could influence him to start keeping Torah mitzvahs again. Right? The Haskalah was raging throughout Eastern Europe. It had influenced and impacted many people in a similar way to how Reform had influenced the Jews of Western Europe and Germany and elsewhere. And so Rav Yisrael went to the innkeeper and he said, please ask her, I hear your daughter is very talented. I hear she's a wonderful musician. Please ask her to play for me. he didn't want to refuse the rabbi, so he goes over to his daughter, he asks her to play, and she refuses. She says, here's my certificate, here's my indication that I've achieved success in the area of music, that I'm proficient, that I'm even better than that. I don't need to play for every single person who comes and who asks of me. And Rabbi Yisrael used that to go back to the father, because the father had said to him when he asked him, what is it, you know, why is it that that you're not keeping the Torah anymore? So his answer was that, you know, he doesn't see any evidence of God. He doesn't see any indication that Hashem is really with us. We're suffering, we're persecuted, we're poor, right? There's no, you know, maybe, there, you know, we talk about miracles from yesteryear, but did those miracles really occur? And if they did, if Hashem is really with us, I want to see another miracle. And Rabbi Saul said, just like your daughter didn't want to play for me because we already had, let's say, evidence, documentation that she has performed well and she succeeded, she graduated. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lahavdil also had similar documentation. The Torah is very, very clear in all the miracles that Hashem performed. But Rambam goes on and he says that Hashem never wanted our relationship with him, our belief in him, to be framed by miracles, because miracles ultimately lead to dophi. They lead to doubt. Because the miracle, you know, there are different ways to interpret things. You can question what actually happened and all of that. But the Kuzari says, and this really is what the distinguishing quality that separates Judaism from all other religions, monotheistic in particular, but all religions, is that we're the only nation that can claim that the miracles that took place for us took place in the presence of millions of people. Whereas Christianity, for example, or Islam, their founders claimed certain miracles to have occurred to them, or the followers claimed that it happened to the founders. But it was a handful of people, and certainly that's a suspect, a very limited scope as far as who may have witnessed or observed those particular miracles. In Judaism, there was no question. But it wasn't the miracles themselves that we'd latch on to. We talk about them, obviously. We they are a center part of our identity. But it's the Mesorah, it's the connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the relationship with Hashem directly, where he spoke to Klal Yisrael around Har Sinai. And we witnessed that, we heard it, we saw it, we felt it. And the pacha, the ema, continues to reverberate till today. So us having that tradition and our ability to pass that down from one generation to another, that's ultimately what we rely on more than anything else. So while it certainly seems to be a difficulty when we imagine people dropping so rapidly from the heights of Kriyas Yamsuf, right? Zekeli v'anvehu, even the lowest of the Shivchas saw more at that moment than Yechezkel ben Buzi, Chazal tell us. So clearly they were at a very, very high level. But if you experience miracles only, if your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is external, if it's driven by things that are beyond your control, where Hashem is, you know, doing miraculous things to draw attention to his power, but it's not coming from an intrinsic recognition, an intrinsic desire to connect, an intrinsic sense of personal growth that is necessary, then it's easy to rise quickly and to fall quickly. And that's something that we see time and again. And it's only through the day-to-day work, and that's really what we represent when we talk about the 49-day buildup from Pesach until Shavuos. We always talk about how Klal Yisrael had to emerge from the Memtesh Sharei Tumah and move two steps a day, two levels a day, so to speak, until they could arrive at the Memtesh Sharei Kedusha, really at the precipice of Har Sinai, and be able and be ready to mekabel the Torah. So I believe that those who really put in that effort, those were the ones who were able to sustain those levels. But those that were reliant primarily on miracles, that's where, you know, the real risk is. And that's why it's so important that our emunah and our bitachon not be reliant on Nisim, first and foremost, but on the fact that we understand that there's a real purpose in this world. We understand that there's a creator, and that the world wasn't created by accident, and there's a purpose of our existence, and we specifically as Klal Yisrael have a particular role in order to advance, you know, Hashem's mission in this world, and to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. All of those things, we recognize all of those things, we live. And of course, as we talked about Jewish history before, so we've experienced it time and again in so many different ways. And the very fact that we've been persecuted for our beliefs, the fact that so many nations intrinsically deep down recognize that we are special and resent us for it, and simultaneously here we are. Right? We are the greatest miracle perhaps in the history of the world, if you think about it like that, because of the fact that we have withstood all of the various challenges. Mark Twain writes about it. We want to use contemporary sources, but we recognize that our existence cannot be, let's call it, accidental. It's based on a deep relationship with Hashem. Anyway, so that's something that I was thinking about as I was looking at the ego. But let's talk about the ego itself for a moment, because you know I happen to be working in the realm of coaching and leadership and whatnot, and it's fascinating to me to see how Moshe Rabbeinu responds to the situation as it's presented to him. So Perek Lamed Beis is where we encounter the story of the ego. That's where it first begins. And Moshe is delayed, and people gather around Aaron. Aaron's role is an interesting one. I'm not going to dive into it right now, but clearly Aaron wasn't able to put the people at bay, and they clamored for some kind of solution. Aaron tells them to bring their gold. They bring it more quickly than he anticipated. And one thing leads to another, and now we have this ego masecha, and the people are crying and screaming, Eile Elokecha Yisrael Asher Alucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. These are your gods which you took out from the land of Mitzrayim. So even though we know that Judaism is a monotheistic religion, which there is no form of Hashem in any sense, but clearly these individuals who were involved were looking for some kind of physical connection, some kind of symbolic gesture that would connect them. And there is a human, drive or desire to have something physical. It is challenging, so to speak, in many ways, to connect to this concept of a God that you cannot see or interact with in any way, shape, or form. But nonetheless, it's obviously a tremendous avera. And they're dancing, and they're being mesachik and all of that. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Moshe, and he says, Lech Reid. Go down, kishiches amcha, because your nation has become corrupt, that you brought up from Mitzrayim. So Hashem throws it on Moshe. He says, it's your nation, and they've become corrupt. You go deal with it, so to speak. Saru maher min aderach asher tzivisam asulam ego masecha. They have deviated, they've made this ego, and they're bowing to it, and they're sacrificing to it, and they're screaming, Eilo lepecha Yisrael, etc. And what is... And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls him Am Sheoras. And he says, Hanichali, leave me alone. Ba'ichar api v'hem v'achaleim, I'm going to go destroy them. V'esha oscha l'goygadol, and he says he's going to recreate Klal Yisrael through Moshe Rabbeinu. And what does Moshe do in the famous pasuk Vayichal Moshe that we read on fast days? Moshe immediately turns to Hashem and begins the process of trying to shift the discourse and achieve kapara for Klal Yisrael. And he says, number one, Lama Hashem Yechar Abcha Ba'amecha, why are you getting angry in your nation? So Hashem had called the nation Moshe's nation. Moshe calls the nation Hashem's nation. Right? Asher Tzisir Me'eretz Mitzrayim. You brought them out of Mitzrayim. B'choch Gadol B'yad Chazaka. So a moment ago, Hashem is saying, you Moshe took them out. And Moshe is saying, no, you Hashem took them out. Which is so interesting. Right? It's as if they're having some kind of identity crisis over here as to whose nation they really are. And then Moshe continues, and he says, why should we create a situation where the Mitzrayim are going to say, Yelama Yomur Mitzrayim Lemar Berah Hotziyam Ha'aravasam Baharim, the Egyptians are going to say that they went out Berah, Ra is a reference to the star and the gods, whatever, I'm not going to get into that right now, but that they're going to die in the mountainside, and that they should be destroyed. The Hashem took them out, but he took them out to destroy them. He didn't take them out to make them his nation. He didn't take them out to create a future with them. Took them out to destroy them. So number one, Moshe says that they're your nation, Hashem. You have to take responsibility for their behavior. Number two, He says, look at what you're doing. You're creating a situation where the Egyptians are going to look bad at you because of the way that you allegedly or seemingly took Klal Yisrael out just to destroy them. And then he says, and finally, Zechor l'Avram l'Yitzchak l'Yisrael l'Avadecha, remember the promise that you made to your to my forefathers, the Avos. And he told them, Arba zarachem kechoch ve'ashamayim, I'm going to make your children as numerous as the stars. But you made all these promises to the Avos in terms of their children, in terms of the land, and you're going to violate all of these. And what happens as a result? Reconsidered. But we see the same language, by the way, Parshas Noach, or maybe late Bereishis, beginning of Noach, where we talk about that Hashem was, quote, comforted, but he also, that he revisited, which of course, when we think about Hashem, this whole idea is very strange because it's like, you know, you would imagine that Hashem is absolute truth. And therefore, as a result, there is no negotiation. But clearly, the words, and it seems that the words that kind of triggered a Moshe that he had the opportunity to negotiate is where he says, "Ba'ata hanichali," I mentioned that before, and now leave me, right? As if to say, you know, Moshe hadn't even said anything yet. But Moshe saw that as a Pesach where he could begin the process, if you will, of negotiating. And so Moshe, by making that connection, you know, he started to turn the tide. He started to create, if you will, an opening that would allow for the kapar that he was trying to achieve. And then Moshe, of course, gets down to business. He goes down to the mountain. The luchos are destroyed. And he begins the process of weeding out those that had participated, destroying the ego and everything that follows as a result. And so there's a lot here that's I guess you would say, at least for me, difficult to understand. But it's clear that even when we are in our worst moments, even when we're in a situation where things seem very, very bleak, where we have stepped very much out of line, and it appears that there is no way to fix it, Hashem creates an opening. He always gives us an opportunity with the right approach to achieve kapar. Now, it wasn't the permanent kapar. There were elements of Maimed Har Sinai. Chazal say we're supposed to live forever at that point, and certain other things that we never got back. But the core idea that Klal Yisrael would continue, that the Haftachos to the Avos would be fulfilled, that was restored. And that was really restored because of the Mesiras Nefesh of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe had the opportunity, if you think about it, Moshe had the opportunity to start the nation as his own, right? And what, I don't know that there's any more enticing an idea out there that I could be the founder of a nation that would be Hashem's nation and create a whole history with that nation, etc. And Moshe rejected it categorically. He said, if a three-legged stool can't stand, certainly a one-legged stool is not going to stand. And we see, therefore, the humility of Moshe that he always put Klal Yisrael first. Despite the difficulty, despite the way that the terrible optic, if you will, and the fact that this is all being blamed on him and the nation that he brought out as if it was his responsibility, Moshe stood up very clearly and he said that he's taking responsibility for them, that he's going to take care of it, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to ultimately forgive them, and that's what happens. And Hashem lists the Yud Gimel Midos, which is where we learn that from, and that Teshuvah does take place. So as we think about this Parsha, which again has so many twists and turns, I mentioned at the beginning the fact that there are all these mitzvahs that lead up to the story of the eagle, and they all reference this idea of do it the right way so as to avert any death or avert any consequences. You know, life in many ways is a bit of a balancing act. You know, we're constantly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts us before us as a chayim, as a maves. We have choices to do good. We have choices to do not so good. And the consequences are significant. And the parsha is telling us that you know, not only should we choose life, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is rooting for us in a sense. He's pulling for us to do good. He doesn't want for us for our downfall. He puts the Mishkan chronological, at least as the Torah is presented, in advance of the story of the Egel, as if to say that he's putting the refuah before the Makkah, because again, as we mentioned before, the Mishkan is the indication that Hashem has forgiven us. But it's also the pathway, the Mishkan as the antecedent, if you will, of the Beis HaMikdash. It's also the pathway for a connection with Hashem. Right? It's through the Kabbalah, it's through the Avodah, and nowadays we don't have that. We only have Tfilah, but we have the Neshama Parim Sifaseinu, that's the Tfilah that we utter. That is our connection with Hashem. And that all was, you could say, in a sense, an outgrowth of a moment of crisis, an outgrowth of a moment of failure, of a moment where we really did not live up to the expectations that were made of us, and we were punished severely. And yet, through tshuva, and yet through the willingness to go back and to try again and to do the right thing, and of course to daven, we position ourselves for a long-standing relationship, one which has served us, obviously, very, very well, and has been the foundation of our relationship with Hashem for millennia. And so that, I think with that said, those are some of my primary thoughts on this week's parsha. And I thank you for participating, and I hope that the information that I shared this evening was clear, and that it should inspire us all as we are listening to the laning on Shabbos to think about that special relationship, think about what could have been, and simultaneously recognizing that with the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu, and of course with the love of Hashem for us, that we're able to move from a situation of tragedy to something far better. And in the parshios that follow, we read about the Hakamas HaMishkan, and of course the Avodah that follows in Sefer Vayikra. Wishing everybody a good evening and a good Shabbos.